What did 11-year-olds hear at dinner? What did they understand by jocund military references to that Sulawadi, who always opposed the Pakistan idea? Or to noon, who should have been called sunset, what? And through discussions of election rigging and black money, what undercurrent of danger permeated their skins, making the downy hairs on their arms stand on end? And when the Commander-in-Chief quoted the Quran, how much of its meaning was understood by 11-year-old ears? "It is written," said the round-headed man, and the gongs and pips fell silent, "Ard and Thamud we also destroyed. Satan had made their foul deeds seem fair to them, keen-sighted though they were." It was as though a cue had been given. A wave of my aunt's hands dismissed the servants. She rose to go herself. My mother and Pierre went with her. Zafar and I, too, rose from our seats. But he himself, called down the length of the sumptuous table, "The little men should stay. It is their future, after all." The little men, frightened but also proud, sat and stayed mum, following orders. Just men now. A change in the roundhead's face, something darker, something mottled and desperate has occupied it. 12 months ago, he says, "I spoke to all of you. Give the politicians 1 year. Is that not what I said?" Heads nod, murmurs of assent. "Gentlemen, we have given them 1 year. The situation has become intolerable, and I am not prepared to tolerate it any longer." Gongs and pips assume stern, statesman-like expressions. Jaws are set, eyes gaze keenly into the future. Tonight, therefore. Yes, I was there, a few yards from him. General Ayub and I, myself and old Ayub Khan. I am assuming control of the state. How do 11-year-olds react to the announcement of a coup? Hearing the words, "National finances in frightening disarray. Corruption and impurity are everywhere." Do their jaws stiffen too? Do their eyes focus on brighter tomorrows? 11-year-olds listen as a general cries, "The Constitution is hereby abrogated. Central and provincial legislatures are dissolved. Political parties are forthwith abolished." How do you think they feel? When General Ayub Khan said, "Martial law is now imposed," both Cousin Zafar and I understood that his voice, that voice filled with power and decision, and the rich timbre of my aunt's finest cooking, was speaking a thing for which we knew only one word: treason. I'm proud to say I kept my head. But Zafar lost control of a more embarrassing organ. Moisture stained his trouser fronts. The yellow moisture of fear trickled down his leg to stain Persian carpets. Gongs and pips smelled something and turned upon him with looks of infinite distaste. And then, worst of all, came laughter. General Zulfikar had just begun saying, "If you permit, sir, I shall map out tonight's procedures," when his son wet his pants. In cold fury, my uncle hurled his son from the room. "Pimp! Woman!" followed Zafar out of the dining chamber, in his father's thin, sharp voice. "Coward! Homosexual! Hindu!" leapt from Punchinello face to chase his son up the stairs. Zulfikar's eyes settled on me. There was a plea in them. "Save the honour of the family. Redeem me from the incontinence of my son." "You boy," my uncle said, "you want to come up here and help me?" Of course, I nodded, proving my manhood, my fitness for sonship. I assisted my uncle as he made the revolution. And in so doing, in earning his gratitude, instilling the sniggers of the assembled gongs and pips, I created a new father for myself. General Zulfikar became the latest in a line of men who have been willing to call me Sonny or Sonny Jim or even simply my son. How we made the revolution. General Zulfikar described troop movements. I moved Pepper Potts symbolically while he spoke. In the clutches of the active metaphorical mode of connection, I shifted salt cellars and bowls of chutney. This mustard jar is Company A, occupying head post office. There are two Pepper Potts surrounding a serving spoon, which means Company B has seized the airport. With the fate of the nation in my hands, I shifted condiments and cutlery, capturing empty biryani dishes with water glasses, stationing salt cellars on guard around water jugs, and when General Zulfikar stopped talking, the march of the table service also came to an end. Ayub Khan seemed to settle down in his chair. Was the wink he gave me just my imagination? At any rate, the Commander-in-Chief said, "Very good, Zulfikar. Good show." In the movements performed by Pepper Potts, etc., one table ornament remained uncaptured. A cream jug in solid silver, which, in our tabletop coup, represented the head of state, President Iskander Mirza. For 3 weeks, Mirza remained president. An 11-year-old boy cannot judge whether a president is truly corrupt, even if gongs and pips say he is. It is not for 11-year-olds to say whether Mirza's association with the feeble Republican Party should have disqualified him from high office under the new regime. Salim Sanai made no political judgments, but when, inevitably at midnight, on November 1st, my uncle shook me awake and whispered, "Come on, sonny, it's time you got a taste of the real thing." I leapt out of bed smartly. I dressed and went out into the night, proudly aware that my uncle had preferred my company to that of his own son. Midnight. Rawalpindi speeding past us at 70 mph. Motorcycles in front of us, beside us, behind us. "Where are we going, Zulfi uncle? Wait and see." Black smoke-windowed limousine pausing at darkened house. Sentries guard the door with crossed rifles, which part to let us through. I am marching at my uncle's side, in step, through half-lit corridors, until we burst into a dark room with a shaft of moonlight spotlighting a four-poster bed. A mosquito net hangs over the bed like a shroud. There is a man waking up, startled. What the hell is going? But General Zulfikar has a long-barreled revolver. The tip of the gun is forced, oomph, between the man's parted teeth. "Shut up," my uncle says superfluously. "Come with us." Naked, overweight man stumbling from his bed, his eyes asking, "Are you going to shoot me?" Sweat rolls down ample belly, catching moonlight, dribbling onto his susu. But it is bitterly cold. He is not perspiring from the heat. He looks like a white laughing Buddha, but not laughing, shivering. My uncle's pistol is extracted from his mouth. "Turn! Quick march!" And gun barrel pushed between the cheeks of an overfed rump, the man cries, "For God's sake, be careful! That thing has the safety off!" Javon's giggle, as naked flesh emerges into moonlight, is pushed into black limousine. That night I sat with a naked man as my uncle drove him to a military airfield. I stood and watched as the waiting aircraft taxied, accelerated, flew. What began active metaphorically with Pepper Potts ended then. Not only did I overthrow a government, I also consigned a president to exile. Midnight has many children, the offspring of independence, were not all human. Violence, corruption, poverty, generals, chaos, greed, and Pepper Potts. I had to go into exile to learn that the children of midnight were more varied than I, even I, had dreamed.
"Really? Truly?" Padma asks. "You were truly there?"
"Really, truly. They say that Ayub was a good man before he became bad," Padma says. It is a question, but Salim at 11 made no such judgments. The movement of Pepper Potts does not necessitate moral choices. What Salim was concerned with? Not public upheaval, but personal rehabilitation. You see the paradox? My most crucial foray into history up to that moment was inspired by the most parochial of motives. Anyway, it was not my country. Or not then. Not my country. Although I stayed in it as refugee, not citizen, entered on my mother's Indian passport, I would have come in for a good deal of suspicion. Maybe even deported or arrested as a spy, had it not been for my tender years and the power of my guardian with the punch-like features for 4 long years. 4 years of nothing. Except growing into a teenager. Except watching my mother as she fell apart. Except observing the monkey, who was a crucial year younger than me, fall under the insidious spell of that god-ridden country. The monkey, once so rebellious and wild, adopting expressions of demureness and submission which must at first have seemed false even to her. The monkey, learning how to cook and keep house, how to buy spices in the market. The monkey, making the final break with the legacy of her grandfather by learning prayers in Arabic and saying them at all prescribed times. The monkey, revealing the streak of Puritan fanaticism which she had hinted at when she asked for a nun's outfit. She, who spurned all offers of worldly love, was seduced by the love of that god who had been named after a carved idol in a pagan shrine built around a giant meteorite. Allah, in the Kaaba, the shrine of the great black stone. But nothing else. 4 years away from the Midnight Children, 4 years without Warden Road and Breach Candy and Scandal Point and the lures of 1 yard of chocolates, away from the Cathedral School and the equestrian statue of Shivaji and melon sellers at the Gateway of India, away from Diwali and Ganesh Chaturthi and Coconut Day. 4 years of separation from a father who sat alone in a house he would not sell. Alone. Except for Professor Shapstaker, who stayed in his apartment and shunned the company of men. Can nothing really happen for 4 years? Obviously not quite. My cousin Zafar, who had never been forgiven by his father for wetting his pants in the presence of history, was given to understand that he would be joining the army as soon as he was of age. "I want to see you prove you're not a woman," his father told him. And Bonzo died. General Zulfikar shed manly tears, and Mary's confession faded until, because nobody spoke of it, it came to feel like a bad dream to everyone except me. And, without any assistance from me, relations between India and Pakistan grew worse, entirely without my help. India conquered Goa, the Portuguese pimple on the face of Mother India. I sat on the sidelines and played no part in the acquisition of large-scale US aid for Pakistan. Nor was I to blame for Sino-India border skirmishes in the Aksai Chin region of Ladakh. The Indian census of 1961 revealed a literacy level of 23.7%. But I was not entered in its records. The untouchable problem remained acute. I did nothing to alleviate it. And in the elections of 1962, the All India Congress won 361 out of 494 seats in the Lok Sabha, and over 61% of all state assembly seats. Not even in this could my unseen hand be said to have moved, except, perhaps, metaphorically. The status quo was preserved in India. In my life, nothing changed either. Then, on September 1st, 1962, we celebrated the monkey's 14th birthday. By this time, and despite my uncle's continued fondness for me, we were well established as social inferiors, the hapless poor relations of the great Zulfikars. So the party was a skimpy affair. The monkey, however, gave every appearance of enjoying herself. "It's my duty, brother," she told me. I could hardly believe my ears. But perhaps my sister had an intuition of her fate. Perhaps she knew the transformation which lay in store for her. Why should I assume that I alone have had the powers of secret knowledge? Perhaps then she guessed that when the hired musicians began to play, Shenai and Veena were present, Sarangi and Sarud had their turns, tabla and sitar perform their virtuosic cross-examinations, Emerald Zulfikar would descend on her with callous elegance, demanding, "Come on, Jamila, don't sit there like a melon. Sing us a song like any good girl would." And that with this sentence, my emerald icy aunt would have begun, quite unwittingly, my sister's transformation from monkey into singer. Because although she protested with the sullen clumsiness of 14-year-olds, she was hauled unceremoniously onto the musician's dais by my organizing aunt. And although she looked as if she wished the floor would open up beneath her feet, she clasped her hands together. Seeing no escape, the monkey began to sing. I have not, I think, been good at describing emotions, believing my audience to be capable of joining in, of imagining for themselves what I have been unable to reimagine, so that my story becomes yours as well. But when my sister began to sing, I was certainly assailed by an emotion of such force that I was unable to understand it until, much later, it was explained to me by the oldest whore in the world. Because, with her first note, the brass monkey sloughed off her nickname. She, who had talked to birds just as long ago in a mountain valley her great-grandfather used to do, must have learned from songbirds the arts of song. With one good ear and one bad ear, I listened to her faultless voice, which at 14 was the voice of a grown woman, filled with the purity of wings and the pain of exile, and the flying of eagles, and the lovelessness of life, and the melody of bulbuls, and the glorious omnipresence of God. A voice which was afterwards compared to that of Muhammad's muezzin Bilal, issuing from the lips of a somewhat scrawny girl. What I did not understand must wait to be told. Let me record here that my sister earned her name at her 14th birthday party and was known after that as Jamila Singer, and that I knew as I listened to My Red Dupatta of Muslin and Shabaz Kalanda that the process which had begun during my first exile was nearing completion in my second, that from now on, Jamila was the child who mattered, and that I must take second place to her talent forever. Jamila sang. I humbly bowed my head, but before she could enter fully into her kingdom, something else had to happen. I had to be properly finished off. Drainage and the Desert. What chews on bones refuses to pause. It's only a matter of time. This is what keeps me going. I hold on to Padma. Padma is what matters. Padma muscles. Padma's hairy forearms. Padma, my own pure lotus, who, embarrassed, commands, "Enough! Start! Start now!" Yes, it must start with the cable. Telepathy set me apart. Telecommunications dragged me down. Amina Sinai was cutting verrucas out of her feet when the telegram arrived. Once upon a time. No, that won't do. There's no getting away from the date. My mother, right ankle on left knee, was scooping corn tissue out of the sole of her foot with a sharp-ended nail file on September 9th, 1962. And the time. The time matters, too. Well, then, in the afternoon. No, it's important to be more... At the stroke of 3 o'clock, which, even in the north, is the hottest time of day, a bearer brought her an envelope on a silver dish. A few seconds later, far away in New Delhi, Defence Minister Krishna Menon, acting on his own initiative during Nehru's absence at the Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference, took the momentous decision to use force, if necessary, against the Chinese army on the Himalayan frontier. "The Chinese must be ejected from the Thagla Ridge," Mr. Menon said, while my mother tore open a telegram. "No weakness will be shown." But this decision was a mere trifle when set beside the implications of my mother's cable. Because while the eviction operation codenamed Leghorn, was doomed to fail and eventually to turn India into that most macabre of theatres, the theatre of war, the cable was to plunge me secretly but surely towards the crisis which would end with my final eviction from my own inner world. While the Indian 33rd Corps were acting on instructions passed from Menon to General Thapa, I, too, had been placed in great danger, as if unseen forces had decided that I had also overstepped the boundaries of what I was permitted to do, or know, or be, as though history had decided to put me firmly in my place. I was left entirely without a say in the matter. My mother read the telegram, burst into tears, and said, "Children, we are going home." After which, as I began by saying in another context, it was only a matter of time. What the telegram said: "Please come quick. Sinai Saab suffered heart boot. Gravely ill. Salams. Alice Pereira."
"Of course, go at once, my darling," my Aunt Emerald told her sister. "But what, my God, can be this heart boot?"
It is possible, even probable, that I am only the first historian to write the story of my undeniably exceptional life and times. Those who follow in my footsteps will, however, inevitably come to this present work, this source book, this hadith, or purana, or grundrisse, for guidance and inspiration. I say to these future exegetes, when you come to examine the events which followed on from the heartboot cable, remember that at the very eye of the hurricane which was unleashed upon me, the sword, to switch metaphors, with which the coup de grace was applied, there lay a single unifying force. I refer to telecommunications. Telegrams, and after telegrams, telephones, were my undoing. Generously, however, I shall accuse nobody of conspiracy, although it would be easy to believe that the controllers of communication had resolved to regain their monopoly of the nation's airwaves. I must return, Padma is frowning, to the banal chain of cause and effect. We arrived at Santa Cruz Airport by Dakota on September 16th, but to explain the telegram, I must go further back in time. If Alice Pereira had once sinned by stealing Joseph da Costa from her sister Mary, she had, in these latter years, gone a long way towards attaining redemption, because for 4 years she had been Ahmed Sinai's only human companion. Isolated on the dusty hillock which had once been Methil's estate, she had borne enormous demands on her accommodating good nature. He would make her sit with him until midnight while he drank gins and ranted about the injustices of his life. He remembered, after years of forgetfulness, his old dream of translating and reordering the Quran, and blamed his family for emasculating him so that he didn't have the energy to begin such a task. In addition, because she was there, his anger often directed itself at her, taking the form of long tirades filled with gutter oaths and the useless curses he had devised in the days of his deepest abstraction. She attempted to be understanding. He was a lonely man. His once infallible relationship with the telephone had been destroyed by the economic vagaries of the times. His touch in financial matters had begun to desert him. He fell prey, too, to strange fears. When the Chinese road in the Aksai Chin region was discovered, he became convinced that the yellow hordes would be arriving at Methil's estate in a matter of days. And it was Alice who comforted him with ice-cold Coca-Cola, saying, "No good worrying. Those Chinkies are too little to beat our Javans. Better you drink your Coke. Nothing is going to change." In the end, he wore her out. She stayed with him, finally, only because she demanded and received large pay increases and sent much of the money to Goa for the support of her sister Mary. But on September 1st, she too succumbed to the blandishments of the telephone. By then, she spent as much time on the instrument as her employer, particularly when the Nalika women called up. The formidable Nalikas were, at that time, besieging my father, telephoning him twice a day, coaxing and persuading him to sell, reminding him that his position was hopeless, flapping around his head like vultures around a burning godown. On September 1st, like a long-ago vulture, they flung down an arm which slapped him in the face because they bribed Alice Pereira away from him. Unable to stand him any more, she cried, "Answer your own telephone, I'm off!" That night, Amit Sanai's heart began to bulge, overfull of hate, resentment, self-pity, grief. It became swollen like a balloon. It beat too hard, skipped beats, and finally felled him like an ox. At the Breach Candy Hospital, the doctors discovered that my father's heart had actually changed shape. A new swelling had pushed lumpily out of the lower left ventricle. It had, to use Alice's word, booted. Alice found him the next day when, by chance, she returned to collect a forgotten umbrella. Like a good secretary, she enlisted the power of telecommunications, telephoning an ambulance and telegramming us. Owing to censorship of the mails between India and Pakistan, the heartboot cable took a full week to reach Amina Sinai. "Back to bomb!" I yelled happily. "Alarming airport coolies, back to bomb!" I cheered despite everything until the newly sober Jamila said, "Oh, Salim, honestly, shoo!" Alice Pereira met us at the airport. A telegram had alerted her. And then we were in a real Bombay black and yellow taxi, and I was wallowing in the sounds of Hot Channa Hot Hawkers. The throng of camels, bicycles, and people, 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 thinking how Mumbadevi City made Rawalpindi look like a village. Rediscovering especially the colours, the forgotten vividness of Gulmohr and Bougainvillea, the livid green of the waters of the Mahalakshmi temple tank, the stark black and white of the traffic policemen's sun umbrellas, and the blue and yellowness of their uniforms, but most of all the blue, blue, blue of the sea. Only the grey of my father's stricken face distracted me from the rainbow riot of the city and made me sober up. Alice Pereira left us at the hospital and went off to work for the Nalika women. And now a remarkable thing happened. My mother, Amina Sanai, jerked out of lethargy and depression and guilt fogs and verruca pain by the sight of my father, seemed miraculously to regain her youth. With all her old gifts of assiduity restored, she set about the rehabilitation of Amit, driven by an unstoppable will. She brought him home to the first-floor bedroom in which she had nursed him through the freeze. She sat with him day and night, pouring her strength into his body. And her love had its reward, because not only did Amit Sanai make a recovery so complete as to astound Breach Candy's European doctors, but also an altogether more wonderful change occurred, which was that, as Amit came to himself under Amina's care, he returned not to the self which had practiced curses and wrestled jinns, but to the self he might always have been, filled with contrition and forgiveness and laughter and generosity, and the finest miracle of all, which was love. Amit Sanai had at long last fallen in love with my mother, and I was the sacrificial lamb with which they anointed their love. They had even begun to sleep together again, and although my sister, with a flash of her old monkey self, said, "In the same bed, Allah Chichi, how dirty!" I was happy for them, and even, briefly, happier for myself, because I was back in the land of the Midnight Children's Conference. While newspaper headlines marched towards war, I renewed my acquaintance with my miraculous fellows, not knowing how many endings were in store for me. On October 9th, Indian Army poised for all-out effort. I felt able to convene the conference. Time and my own efforts had erected the necessary barrier around Mary's secret. Back into my head they came. It was a happy night. A night for burying old disagreements, for making our own all-out effort at reunion. We repeated over and over again our joy at being back together, ignoring the deeper truth that we were like all families, that family reunions are more delightful in prospect than in reality, and that the time comes when all families must go their separate ways. On October 15th, unprovoked attack on India. The questions I'd been dreading and trying not to provoke began, why is Shiva not here, and why have you closed off part of your mind? On October 20th, the Indian forces were defeated, thrashed by the Chinese at Thag La Ridge. An official Peking statement announced, in self-defense, Chinese frontier guards were compelled to strike back resolutely. But when, that same night, the Children of Midnight launched a concerted assault on me, I had no defense. They attacked on a broad front, and from every direction, accusing me of secrecy, prevarication, high-handedness, egotism. My mind, no longer a parliament chamber, became the battleground on which they annihilated me. No longer Big Brother Salim, I listened helplessly while they tore me apart, because despite all their sound and fury, I could not unblock what I had sealed away. I could not bring myself to tell them Mary's secret. Even Parvati the witch, for so long my fondest supporter, lost patience with me at last. Oh, Salim, she said, God knows what that Pakistan has done to you, but you are badly changed. Once, long ago, the death of me and Abdullah had destroyed another conference, which had been held together purely by the strength of his will. Now, as the Midnight Children lost faith in me, they also lost their belief in the thing I had made for them. Between October 20th and November 20th, I continued to convene, to attempt to convene, our nightly sessions, but they fled from me, not one by one, but in tens and twenties. Each night, less of them were willing to tune in. Each week, over 100 of them retreated into private life. In the high Himalayas, Gurkhas and Rajputs fled in disarray from the Chinese army, and in the upper reaches of my mind, another army was also destroyed by things, bickerings, prejudices, boredom, selfishness, which I had believed too small, too petty to have touched them. But optimism, like a lingering disease, refused to vanish. I continue to believe, I continue now, that what we had in common would finally have outweighed what drove us apart. No, I will not accept the ultimate responsibility for the end of the Children's Conference, because what destroyed all possibility of renewal was the love of Ahmed and Amina Sinai. And Shiva? Shiva, whom I cold-bloodedly denied his birthright. Never once in that last month did I send my thoughts in search of him, but his existence somewhere in the world nagged away at the corners of my mind. Shiva the Destroyer, Shiva Knockknees, he became for me first a stabbing twinge of guilt, then an obsession, and finally, as the memory of his actuality grew dull, he became a sort of principle. He came to represent in my mind all the vengefulness and violence and simultaneous love and hate of things in the world, so that even now, when I hear of drowned bodies floating like balloons on the Hooghly and exploding when nudged by passing boats, or trains set on fire or politicians killed or riots in Orissa or Punjab, it seems to me that the hand of Shiva lies heavily over all these things, dooming us to flounder endlessly amid murder, rape, greed, war, that Shiva, in short, has made us who we are. He, too, was born on the stroke of midnight. He, like me, was connected to history. The modes of connection, if I'm right in thinking they applied to me, enabled him, too, to affect the passage of the days. I'm talking as if I never saw him again, which isn't true. But that, of course, must get into the queue like everything else. I'm not strong enough to tell that tale just now. The disease of optimism in those days once again attained epidemic proportions. I, meanwhile, was afflicted by an inflammation of the sinuses, curiously triggered off by the defeat of Thag La Ridge. Public optimism about the war grew as fat and as dangerous as an overfilled balloon. My long-suffering nasal passages, however, which had been overfilled all their days, finally gave up the struggle against congestion. while parliamentarians poured out speeches about Chinese aggression and the blood of our martyred Javans, my eyes began to stream with tears, while the nation puffed itself up, convincing itself that the annihilation of the little yellow men was at hand. My sinuses, too, puffed up and distorted a face which was already so startling that Ayub Khan himself had stared at it in open amazement. In the clutches of the optimism disease, students burned Mao Zedong and Chou Enlai in effigy. With optimism fever on their brows, mobs attacked Chinese shoemakers, curio dealers and restaurateurs. Burning with optimism, the government even interned Indian citizens of Chinese descent, now enemy aliens, in camps in Rajasthan. Birla Industries donated a miniature rifle range to the nation. Schoolgirls began to go on military parade, but I, Salim, felt as if I was about to die of asphyxiation. The air, thickened by optimism, refused to enter my lungs. Ahmed and Amina Sanai were amongst the worst victims of the renewed disease of optimism. Having already contracted it through the medium of their newborn love, they entered into the public enthusiasm with a will. When Moraji Desai, the urine-drinking finance minister, launched his Ornaments for Armaments appeal, my mother handed over gold bangles and emerald earrings. When Moraji floated an issue of defence bonds, Ahmed Sanai bought them in bushels. War, it seemed, had brought a new dawn to India. In the Times of India, a cartoon captioned War with China showed Nehru looking at graphs labelled Emotional Integration, Industrial Peace, and People's Faith in Government and crying, We never had it so good. Adrift in the sea of optimism, we, the nation, my parents, I floated blindly towards the reefs. As a people, we are obsessed with correspondences. Similarities between this and that, between apparently unconnected things, make us clap our hands delightedly when we find them out. It is a sort of national longing for form, or perhaps simply an expression of our deep belief that forms lie hidden within reality, that meaning reveals itself only in flashes. Hence our vulnerability to omens. When the Indian flag was first raised, for instance, a rainbow appeared above that Delhi field, a rainbow of saffron and green, and we felt blessed. Born amidst correspondence, I have found it continuing to hound me. While Indians headed blindly towards a military debacle, I too was nearing, and entirely without knowing it, a catastrophe of my own. Times of India cartoon spoke of emotional integration. In Buckingham Villa, last remnant of Methil's estate, emotions had never been so integrated. Ahmed and Amina spent their days like just courting youngsters, and while the Peking peoples daily complained, the Nehru government has finally shed its cloak of non-alignment, neither my sister nor I were complaining, because for the first time in years, we did not have to pretend we were non-aligned in the war between our parents. What war had done for India, the cessation of hostilities had achieved on our two-story hillock. Ahmed Sanai had even given up his nightly battle with the jinns. By November 1st, Indians attack under cover of artillery. My nasal passages were in a state of acute crisis. Although my mother subjected me to daily torture by Vicks inhaler and steaming bowls of Vicks ointment dissolved in water, which blanket overhead I was obliged to try and inhale, my sinuses refused to respond to treatment. This was the day on which my father held out his arms to me and said, Come, son, come here and let me love you. In a frenzy of happiness, maybe the optimism disease had got to me after all, I allowed myself to be smothered in his squashy belly. But when he let me go, nose goo had stained his bush shirt. I think that's what finally doomed me, because that afternoon my mother went on to the attack. Pretending to me that she was telephoning a friend, she made a certain telephone call. While Indians attacked under cover of artillery, Amina Sanai planned my downfall. Protected by a lie. Before I describe my entry into the desert of my later years, however, I must admit the possibility that I have grievously wronged my parents. Never once, to my knowledge, never once in all the time since Mary Pereira's revelations did they set out to look for the true son of their blood. And I have, at several points in this narrative, ascribed this failure to a certain lack of imagination. I have said, more or less, that I remained their son because they could not imagine me out of the role. And there are worse interpretations possible too, such as their reluctance to accept into their bosom an urchin who had spent 11 years in the gutter. But I wish to suggest a nobler motive. Maybe despite everything, despite cucumber nose, stain face, chinlessness, horn temples, bandy legs, finger loss, monk's tonsure, and my, admittedly unknown to them, bad left ear, despite even the midnight baby swap of Mary Pereira, maybe, I say, in spite of all these provocations, my parents loved me. I withdrew from them into my secret world, fearing their hatred. I did not admit the possibility that their love was stronger than ugliness, stronger even than blood. It is certainly likely that what a telephone call arranged, what finally took place on November 21, 1962, was done for the highest of reasons, that my parents ruined me for love. The day of November 20th was a terrible day. The night was a terrible night. 6 days earlier, on Nehru's 73rd birthday, the great confrontation with the Chinese forces had begun. The Indian Army, Jawan's swing into action, had attacked the Chinese at Wollong. News of the disaster of Wollong and the rout of General Cowell and 4 battalions reached Nehru on Saturday 18th. On Monday 20th, it flooded through radio and press and arrived at Methil's estate. Ultimate panic in New Delhi, Indian forces in tatters. That day, the last day of my old life, I sat huddled with my sister and parents around our Telefunken radiogram, while telecommunications struck the fear of God and China into our hearts. And my father now said a fearful thing. "Wife," he intoned gravely, while Jamila and I shook with fear, "Begum Sahiba, this country is finished, bankrupt, fantush." The evening paper proclaimed the end of the optimism disease. Public morale drains away. And after that end, there were others to come. Other things would also drain away. I went to bed with my head full of Chinese faces, guns, tanks. But at midnight, my head was empty and quiet because the midnight conference had drained away as well. The only one of the magic children who was willing to talk to me was Parvati the Witch. And we, dejected utterly by what Nussie the Duck would have called the end of the world, were unable to do more than simply commune in silence. And other more mundane drainages. A crack appeared in the mighty Bakra Nungal hydroelectric dam, and the great reservoir behind it flooded through the fissure. And the Nalaka Women's Reclamation Consortium, impervious to optimism or defeat or anything except the lure of wealth, continued to draw land out of the depths of the seas. But the final evacuation, the one which truly gives this episode its title, took place the next morning, just when I had relaxed and thought that something, after all, might turn out all right. Because in the morning we heard the improbably joyous news that the Chinese had suddenly, without needing to, stopped advancing. Having gained control of the Himalayan heights, they were apparently content. "Ceasefire!" the newspapers screamed, and my mother almost fainted in relief. There was talk that General Cowell had been taken prisoner. The President of India, Dr. Radhakrishnan, commented, "Unfortunately, this report is completely untrue." Despite streaming eyes and puffed-up sinuses, I was happy. Despite even the end of the children's conference, I was basking in the new glow of happiness which permeated Buckingham Villa. So when my mother suggested, "Let's go and celebrate. A picnic, children. You'd like that?" I naturally agreed with alacrity. It was the morning of November 21st. We helped make sandwiches and parathas. We stopped at a fizzy drink shop and loaded ice in a tin tub and cokes in a crate into the boot of our rover. Parents in the front, children in the back, we set off. Jimala Singha sang for us as we drove. Through inflamed sinuses, I asked, "Where are we going?" "Juhu? Elephanta? Marve? Where?" And my mother, smiling awkwardly, "Surprise, wait and see." Through streets filled with relieved, rejoicing crowds, we drove. "This is the wrong way," I exclaimed. "This isn't the way to a beach." My parents both spoke at once reassuringly, brightly, "Just one stop first, and then we're off, promise." Telegrams recalled me, radiograms frightened me, but it was a telephone which booked the date, time, place of my undoing, and my parents lied to me. We halted in front of an unfamiliar building in Karnak Road, exterior crumbling, all its windows blind. "You coming with me, son?" Amits and I got out of the car. I, happy to be accompanying my father on his business, walked jauntily beside him. A brass plate on the doorway. "Ear, nose, throat, clinic." And I, suddenly alarmed. "What's this, Abba? Why have we come?" And my father's hand tightening on my shoulder. And then a man in a white coat. And nurses. And, "Ah, yes, Mr. Sanai. So, this is young Salim. Right on time. Fine, fine." While I, "Abba, no. What about the picnic?" But doctors are steering me along now. My father is dropping back. The man in the coat calls to him, "Shan't be long. Damn good news about the war, no?" And the nurse, "Please accompany me for dressing and anesthesia." Tricked. Tricked, Padma. I told you. Once picnics tricked me, and then there was a hospital and a room with a hard bed and bright hanging lamps and me crying, "No, no, no!" And the nurse, "Don't be stupid now. You're almost a grown man. Lie down." And I, remembering how nasal passages had started everything in my head, how nasal fluid had been sniffed up, up, up into somewhere that nose fluid shouldn't go, how the connection had been made, which released my voices, was kicking, yelling, so that they had to hold me down. "Honestly," the nurse said, "such a baby I never saw." And so what began in a washing chest ended on an operating table, because I was held down hand and foot, and a man saying, "You won't feel a thing. Easier than having your tonsils out. Getting those sinuses fixed in no time. Complete clear out." And me, "No, no, please, no." But the voice continued, "I'll put this mask on you now. Just count to 10. Count. The numbers marching, 1, 2, 3, hiss of released gas. The numbers crushing me, 4, 5, 6. Faces swimming in fog, and still the tumultuous numbers. I was crying, I think. The numbers pounding, 7, 8, 9, 10. Good God, the boy's still conscious. Extraordinary. We'd better try another. Can you hear me? Salim, isn't it? Good chap. Just give me another 10. Can't catch me. Multitudes have teemed inside my head. The master of the numbers, me. Here they go again. 11, 12. But they'll never let up until 13, 14, 15. Oh, God, oh, God, the fog. Dizzy and falling back, back, back. 16, beyond war and pepper pots, back, back. 17, 18, 19, 20. There was a washing chest and a boy who sniffed too hard. His mother undressed and revealed a black mango. Voices came, which were not the voices of archangels. A hand deafening the left ear, and what grew best in the heat? Fantasy, irrationality, lust. There was a clock tower refuge, and cheatery in class, and love in Bombay caused a bicycle accident, horn temples entered forcep hollows, and 581 children visited my head. Midnight's children, who may have been the embodiment of the hope of freedom, who may also have been freaks who ought to be finished off. Poverty the witch, most loyal of all, and Shiva, who became a principle of life. There was a question of purpose, and the debate between ideas and things. There were knees and nose, and nose and knees. Quarrels began, and the adult world infiltrated the children's. There was selfishness and snobbishness, and hate. And the impossibility of a third principle, the fear of coming to nothing after all, began to grow. And what nobody said, that the purpose of the 581 lay in their destruction, that they had come in order to come to nothing. Prophecies were ignored when they spoke to this effect. And revelations, and the closing of a mind, an exile, and 4 years after return, suspicions growing, dissension breeding, departures in 20s and 10s, and after the end, just one voice left. But optimism lingered. What we had in common retained the possibility of overpowering what forced us apart. Until... Silence outside me. A dark room. Blinds down. Can't see anything. Nothing there to see. Silence inside me. A connection broken forever. Can't hear anything. Nothing there to hear. Silence like a desert and a clear, free nose. Nasal passages full of air. Air like a vandal invading my private places. Drained. I have been drained. The Paramahamsa grounded for good. Oh, spell it out, spell it out! The operation whose ostensible purpose was the draining of my inflamed sinuses and the once-and-for-all clearing of my nasal passages had the effect of breaking whatever connection had been made in a washing chest, of depriving me of nose-given telepathy, of banishing me from the possibility of midnight children. Our names contain our fates. Living as we do in a place where names have not acquired the meaninglessness of the West and are still more than mere sounds, we are also the victims of our titles. Sinai contains Ibn Sina, Master Magician, Sufi Adept, and also Sin the Moon, the ancient god of Hadramaut. With his own mode of connection, his powers of action at a distance upon the tides of the world. But Sin is also the letter S, as sinuous as a snake. Serpents lie coiled within the name. And there is also the accident of transliteration. Sinai, when in Roman script, though not in Nastaliq, is also the name of the place of revelation, of put off thy shoes, of commandments and golden calves. But when all that is said and done, when Ibn Sina is forgotten, and the moon has set, when snakes lie hidden and revelations end, it is the name of the desert, of barrenness, infertility, dust. The name of the end. In Arabia, Arabia Deserta, at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, other prophets also preached. Muslama of the tribe of Banu Hanifa in the Yamama, the very heart of Arabia, and Hanzala ibn Safwan, and Khalid ibn Sinan. Maslama's god was Ar-Rahman, the merciful. Today, Muslims pray to Allah Ar-Rahman. Khalid ibn Sinan was sent to the tribe of Abs. For a time, he was followed, but then he was lost. Prophets are not always false, simply because they are overtaken and swallowed up by history. Men of worth have always roamed the desert. "Wife," Ahmed Sinai said, "this country is finished. After ceasefire and drainage, these words returned to haunt him, and Amina began to persuade him to emigrate to Pakistan, where her surviving sisters already were, and to which her mother would go after her father's death.
"A fresh start," she suggested. "Janum, it would be lovely. What is left for us on this godforsaken hill?"
So, in the end, Buckingham Villa was delivered into the clutches of the Nalaka women after all, and over 15 years late, my family moved to Pakistan, the land of the pure. Amits and I left very little behind. There are ways of transmitting money with the help of multinational companies, and my father knew those ways, and I, although sad to leave the city of my birth, was not unhappy about moving away from the city in which Shiva lurked somewhere like a carefully concealed landmine. We left Bombay finally in February 1963, and on the day of our departure I took an old tin globe down to the garden and buried it amongst the cacti. Inside it, a Prime Minister's letter and a jumbo-sized front-page baby snap, captioned Midnight's Child. They may not be holy relics. I do not presume to compare the trivial memorabilia of my life with the Hazratbal hair of the Prophet, or the body of St. Francis Xavier in the Cathedral of Bom Jesus. But they are all that has survived of my past. A squashed tin globe, a mildewed letter, a photograph. Nothing else, not even a silver spittoon. Apart from a monkey-crushed planet, the only records are sealed in the closed books of heaven. Sijin and Ilion, the books of evil and good. At any rate, that's the story. Only when we were aboard SS Sabarmati and anchored off the Rann of Kutch did I remember old Shapstecker and wondered, suddenly, if anyone had told him we were going. I didn't dare to ask, for fear that the answer might be no. So, as I thought of the demolition crew getting to work and pictured the machines of destruction smashing into my father's office and my own blue room pulling down the servant's spiral iron staircase and the kitchen in which Mary Pereira had stirred her fears into chutneys and pickles, massacring the veranda where my mother had sat with the child in her belly like a stone, I also had an image of a mighty swinging ball crashing into the domain of Shapstecker Saab, and of the old crazy man himself, pale, wasted, flick-tongued, being exposed there on top of a crumbling house amid falling towers and red-tiled roof, old Shapstecker shriveling, aging, dying in the sunlight, which he hadn't seen for so many years. But perhaps I'm dramatizing. I may have got all this from an old film called Lost Horizon, in which beautiful women shriveled and died when they departed from Shangri-La. For every snake, there is a ladder. For every ladder, a snake. We arrived in Karachi on February 9th, and within months my sister Jamila had been launched on the career which would earn her the names of Pakistan's Angel and Bulbul of the Faith. We had left Bombay, but we gained reflected glory. And one more thing. Although I had been drained, although no voices spoke in my head and never would again, there was one compensation, namely that, for the first time in my life, I was discovering the astonishing delights of possessing a sense of smell. Jamila Singer. It turned out to be a scent so acute as to be capable of distinguishing the glutinous reek of hypocrisy behind the welcoming smile with which my spinster Aunt Alia greeted us at the Karachi docks. Irremediably embittered by my father's years ago defection to the arms of her sister, my headmistress aunt had acquired the heavy-footed corpulence of undimmed jealousy. The thick, dark hairs of her resentment sprouted through most of the pores of her skin, and perhaps she succeeded in deceiving my parents and Jamila with her spreading arms, her waddling run towards us, her cry of, "Amit Bhai at last!" But better late than never. her spider-like and inevitably accepted offers of hospitality, but I, who had spent much of my babyhood in the bitter mittens and soured pom-pom hats of her envy, who had been unknowingly infected with failure by the innocent-looking baby things into which she had knitted her hatred, and who, moreover, could clearly remember what it was like to be possessed by revenge-lust, I, Selim, the drain, could smell the vengeful odours leaking out of her glands. I was, however, powerless to protest. We were swept into the datsun of her vengeance and driven away down Bunder Road to her house at Guru Mandir, like flies, only more foolish, because we celebrated our captivity. But what a sense of smell it was! Most of us are conditioned, from the cradle onwards, into recognizing the narrowest possible spectrum of fragrances. I, however, had been incapable of smelling a thing all my life, and was accordingly ignorant of all olfactory taboos. As a result, I had a tendency not to feign innocence when someone broke wind, which landed me in a certain amount of parental trouble. More important, however, was my nasal freedom to inhale a very great deal more than the sense of purely physical origin with which the rest of the human race has chosen to be content. So, from the earliest days of my Pakistani adolescence, I began to learn the secret aromas of the world, the heady but quick-fading perfume of new love, and also the deeper, longer-lasting pungency of hate. It was not long after my arrival in the land of the pure that I discovered within myself the ultimate impurity of sister love, and the slow burning fires of my aunt filled my nostrils from the start. A nose will give you knowledge, but not power over events. My invasion of Pakistan, armed, if that's the right word, only with a new manifestation of my nasal inheritance, gave me the powers of sniffing out the truth, of smelling what was in the air, of following trails, but not the only power an invader needs, the strength to conquer my foes. I won't deny it. I never forgave Karachi for not being Bombay. Set between the desert and bleakly saline creeks whose shores were littered with stunted mangroves, my new city seemed to possess an ugliness which eclipsed even my own. Having grown too fast, its population had quadrupled since 1947, it had acquired the misshapen lumpiness of a gigantic dwarf. On my 16th birthday, I was given a Lambretta motor scooter. Riding the city streets on my windowless vehicle, I breathed in the fatalistic hopelessness of the slum dwellers and the smug defensiveness of the rich. I was sucked along the smell trails of dispossession and also fanaticism, lured down a long underworld corridor at whose end was the door to Thai Bibi, the oldest whore in the world. But I'm running away with myself. At the heart of my Karachi was Alia Aziz's house, a large old building on Clayton Road. She must have wandered in it for years, like a ghost with nobody to haunt, a place of shadows and yellowed paint, across which there fell every afternoon the long accusing shadow of the minaret of the local mosque. Even when, years later, in the magician's ghetto, I lived in another mosque's shade, a shade which was, at least for a time, a protective, unmenacing penumbra, I never lost my Karachi-born view of mosque shadows, in which, it seemed to me, I could sniff the narrow, clutching, accusative odour of my aunt, who bided her time, but whose vengeance, when it came, was crushing. It was, in those days, a city of mirages. Hewn from the desert, it had not wholly succeeded in destroying the desert's power. Oases shone in the tarmac of Elphinstone Street. Caravanserais were glimpsed, shimmering amongst the hovels around the Black Bridge, the Kalapul. In the rainless city, whose only common factor with the city of my birth was that it, too, had started life as a fishing village, the hidden desert retained its ancient powers of apparition mongering, with the result that Karachiites had only the slipperiest of grasps on reality, and were therefore willing to turn to their leaders for advice on what was real and what was not.